Today is Monday, February 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, there is confusion and some anger over a comment by President Trump about something he said happened with immigrants in Sweden.
Who would believe this? Sweden! They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
Also ahead, the apparent murder of a member of the North Korean leader's family in Malaysia has become an even more bizarre story than it has been so far. And the U.S. Space Agency wants your help in finding Planet Nine. It's all on today's International Edition. Was there a terrorist attack in Sweden Friday night? No, there was not. But U.S. President Donald Trump seemed to suggest there had been, leaving the Swedish people baffled by just what the new American leader might have meant by an offhand remark. At a campaign rally Saturday in Florida, President Trump alluded to past terrorist attacks in Europe linked to open borders immigration.
You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
But there were no high-profile terror-linked events in the Scandinavian country Friday night. President Trump did not elaborate on the remark until Sunday night last evening when he tweeted that he was referring to a Fox News broadcast about migrants in Sweden. He tweeted further criticism of Sweden's immigration policies today, saying, quote, the fake news media is trying to say that large-scale immigration in Sweden is not working out just beautifully. Not. Meanwhile, some Swedes mocked Trump on a social media account using the hashtag last night in Sweden. Joining us is VOA, an International Edition social media guru and expert, Andrew Palczewski. I take it this is pretty big on social media.
It is indeed. So it started out with that hashtag last night in Sweden, and then we also saw hashtag Sweden incident, hashtag Sweden attack. And it started out with a bit of confusion, people wondering what's going on, what's happening, an actual genuine concern if something had actually happened. Once people began to realize that Trump had maybe misinterpreted this news report and there wasn't actually a terrorist attack in Sweden, the jokes started to come in. And we actually had former Swedish Foreign Minister Carl Bildt tweeted out, what has he been smoking? And asking about what Trump meant by this. Now, Trump last night...
We tried to call him and get him on the air. We heard nothing back.
Yeah. Well, you should have reached out via Twitter because President Trump last night clarified on what else, Twitter, that his statement as to what was happening in Sweden was in reference to a story that was broadcast on Fox News concerning immigrants in Sweden. So he did try to offer some clarification for that. But by that point, the jokes had already started and were coming in full force. So we saw hashtag Pray for Sweden placed over a picture of IKEA, the cheap furniture retailer based out of Sweden,
saying they were running out of pieces of a wall to build.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing. It was fake IKEA instructions that someone had mocked up for building a border wall. People wondering if IKEA was going to be okay. So a lot of it centered around IKEA. That's probably the best known Swedish company around the world, probably. But a lot of people just making fun at the expense of this supposed attack.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, we know what the president has said. We know what the president has tweeted back, and he's trying to get around this as well as he possibly can. What else is hot?
Well, today here in the U.S. is President's Day, so that's the day that we honor our U.S. presidents. It's actually the birthday of George Washington that we're marking, so that's the actual day. But all presidents are being honored, including our most recent past president, President Barack Obama. A lot of people posting images and pictures of him wishing he would come back, especially after this first month of the Trump administration. And then you have a lot of people honoring President Trump, saying in the first month he's done a lot to move the country forward, Trump supporters praising his work so far. So you have a lot of that back and forth. It'll never end. I mean, we saw this all through the election. They have the left side and the right side going back and forth on social media, and it continues even on President's Day. But one thing we are seeing is a number of cities around the country, people gathering for Not My President's Day anti-Trump rallies. So we're seeing a lot of that organized on social media.
Well, one thing that President Trump keeps saying that is totally true is that his ratings are good.
Well, he's certainly getting a lot of attention on Twitter for his comments.
And the all-news channels and maybe even newspapers are up. But the fake media and even what he calls the not fake media just doing very well by all of this.
I think so. Well, it's certainly in his position as president, he's getting a lot of attention. And then the way that he's using the office and using social media in the office is unprecedented.
I wanted to ask you about the very weird story that we covered last week about the assassination or murder, if you will, of the half-brother of the North Korean leader. Is that still playing pretty well?
It is, because there's a video that's come out today that seems to show part of the assassination going down. It's a little blurry surveillance video from the Kuala Lumpur airport, but that's making the rounds on social media as the plot thickens about who exactly was behind that and what's going on with that story. So you have a lot of amateur sleuths on social media trying to make heads or tails of it.
We will try to make heads and tails out of it coming up in just a few minutes here on International Edition. Andrew Palshefsky, also known as
@APAL on Twitter.
And me, I don't know who.
@VOA Melman. That's what I'm here for.
Thank you.
My
pleasure. Without him here, you can't get in touch with me. Simple as that. Andrew Palshefsky here on International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis says the United States does not intend to seize oil from Iraq, something President Trump has in the past advocated as spoils for U.S. military activity there and to prevent the Islamic State group from selling it. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence says the United States will continue to hold Russia accountable, but President Trump has directed a search for ways to find new common ground with Russia. Diplomatic tensions are rising between North Korea and Malaysia in the aftermath of the apparent assassination of the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And exit polls from Sunday's presidential election in Ecuador put the ruling party's Lenin Moreno ahead of the closest contender among seven opposition candidates, although it's unclear whether he had enough votes to avoid an April runoff. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
In January 2016, two astronomers at the California Institute of Technology provided evidence of a giant planet traveling in an odd, drawn-out orbit in the far reaches of the solar system. The evidence for its existence is based on the gravitational influence the planet seems to have on several minor planet-sized objects beyond the orbit of the solar system's furthest planet, Neptune. Astronomers around the world have been actively scanning the skies since the discovery was announced, hoping to spot the humongous planet. NASA is now seeking the help of citizen scientists to locate Planet Nine with the launch of its new website, Backyard World's Planet Nine. The website features brief movies made from images captured by NASA's Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE, mission. The address for the new NASA website is backyardworlds.org. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Pakistan and Afghanistan have issued conciliatory statements, an apparent attempt to defuse days of border tension stemming from charges that Afghan soil was used for masterminding last week's terrorist attacks in Pakistani cities. Pakistani troops have been staging cross-border shelling to target what authorities claimed were camps of a splinter faction of the anti-state Pakistani Taliban for being behind most of this deadly violence. Joining us on International Edition is Michael Kugelman, the Asia Program Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. Michael, thanks for being with us. Fill us in, if you would, on what's been going on here.
Well, I mean, it's been a very tense few days. Last week was an extremely bloody week for Pakistan. There were a series of terrorist attacks in the country, including the one on Thursday that killed almost 90 people at a Sufi shrine. And the significant thing here is that all of these attacks last week were carried out by terror groups that are based in Afghanistan. And for a number of months, Pakistan has been trying to push the Afghans to deal with terrorist groups that Pakistan claims are not only based in Afghanistan, but are also given sanctuary by Afghanistan. And Afghanistan has not been doing anything about that. And, of course, what Pakistan has been saying here is ironic, given that Afghanistan has long accused Pakistan of harboring terrorists on its soil that carry out attacks in Afghanistan. And I think last week's round of terrorist attacks in Pakistan came so suddenly at a time when terrorist violence had been down in Pakistan that, you know, the country, the government, and the military were simply shocked and appalled. And I think it really was the straw that broke the camel's back and led Pakistan to essentially deliver an ultimatum to Afghanistan that it had to deal with these terrorist groups on its soil or else. And, you know, Pakistan didn't waste any time in sending some mortars into Afghanistan. Pakistan claimed that these targeted terrorist facilities in Afghanistan, but if you talk to Afghans on the ground, they'll say that, in fact, civilian areas were hit and that hundreds of families in Afghanistan were displaced by these Pakistani military shelling. So it's a pretty tense environment. Even, you know, we've had the conciliatory statements on both sides, which is a good sign, but it's pretty tense. It's going to take a long time before things calm down.
Is there any evidence to either claim that the attackers are either being sheltered in Pakistan and crossing the border from Pakistan to Afghanistan or vice versa?
Well, I mean, in 2014, the Pakistani army launched a major counterterrorism offensive in the Pakistani tribal areas that pushed a lot of terrorists into eastern Afghanistan, right on the border with Pakistan. And there's a fair amount of evidence that groups like the Pakistani Taliban and several of its allies, as well as the Afghanistan-Pakistan faction of ISIS, are based in Afghanistan. Now, where evidence is lacking is whether the Afghan state, the Afghan security establishment or intelligence agency, is actually providing sanctuary to these terrorists from Pakistan. I simply don't think that's true. But then again, there's a lot of ill will and a lot of bad blood between Afghanistan and Pakistan, simply because there is a very large amount of evidence that Pakistan provides sanctuary to the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network, groups that target Afghanistan and have been doing so for years.
So where does this go from here?
Well, I think that the first step has already happened. The necessary first step has already happened for the two sides to try to diffuse tensions. But what I really worry about is that essentially each side has demanded that the other produce several dozen terrorists that are claimed to be staging cross-border attacks. And neither Afghanistan nor Pakistan, in my view, is in a position is going to do what the other is asked to do. Specifically, you know, Afghanistan does not have the capacity, quite frankly, to go after all these terrorists that Pakistan says is on Afghan soil. The Afghan armed forces are very much a work in progress. They're struggling to deal with their own domestic insurgency. They're trying to deal with the Afghan Taliban, particularly when you have less U.S. forces in the country. So the Afghan security forces have a lot in their hands. I simply don't think they're going to be able to just go after all, you know, hundreds of terrorists in Afghanistan that Pakistan wanted to. And meanwhile, I don't think Pakistan is going to do what Afghanistan has asked it to do by producing several dozen Taliban members that have been harbored in Pakistan. Pakistan has a very good reason, in its view, to provide sanctuary to these Afghan Taliban and Haqqani forces. They serve a Pakistani national interest of keeping Indians at bay in Afghanistan. So the bottom line here is that neither country is going to do what the other one wants it to do. I don't think we should be talking about a war breaking out between the two countries, but I do think we have to worry about a situation of really ramped up tensions that could lead to cross-border attacks and, you know, limited forms of conflict that fall very short of all-out war. But it simply is a very tense time.
When you say we have to worry, does that mean the West? Does that mean the UN? Does that mean who can handle this, if anybody? If you look through history, nobody's been able to handle anything in that area, right?
Well, you know, when I say we, I mean anyone. The West, surely, but anyone that values the notion of stability. And I do think there's a role for the United States here. You know, in the last U.S. government, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, was very actively in the region to diffuse tensions between all types of different players. The Trump administration has said very little about its Afghanistan policy, but I think that this is a time where the president needs to try to be on the phone, talking to key leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan, trying to get them to lower the tension.
Michael Kugelman is the Asia Program Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. As always, Michael, thanks so much.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Let's turn our attention to North Korea and Malaysia now. Diplomatic tensions are rising between those two countries in the aftermath of the apparent assassination of the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Kuala Lumpur has recalled its ambassador to Pyongyang for consultations after North Korea's envoy to Malaysia, Kang Chol, lashed out at Malaysia after officials rejected the North's demands to release Kim Jong-nam's body and to allow a representative from the North Korean embassy to be present at the autopsy. Kang Chol was summoned by Malaysia's foreign ministry today after he accused Malaysia of trying to conceal something and of colluding and playing into the gallery of external forces. The foreign ministry dismissed the ambassador's claims as baseless. The 45-year-old Kim Jong-nam died en route to a hospital last Monday after he was reportedly accosted and poisoned by two women at Malaysia's Kuala Lumpur International Airport. The Washington Post is reporting that preparations are underway to bring senior North Korean representatives to the U.S. for talks with former U.S. officials, the first such meeting in 5 years. But arrangements have been complicated by Pyongyang's recent ballistic missile test and that mysterious circumstances surrounding the death of the Korean leader's half-brother. Asian Institute for Policy Studies research fellow Go Myung-yeon in Seoul told VOA's Victor Beatty the North wants to be recognized as a nuclear state, and he doesn't view this as a potential breakthrough, but an exploratory effort.
I think North Korea intends to find out more about the Trump administration's ultimate intentions about North Korea.
Has North Korea's position changed on anything substantive?
Nothing at all. Well, one thing that the North Koreans are very good at is consistency. Their objective is clearly to be recognized as a nuclear state by the United States, and I don't think North Korea is willing to entertain the idea of denuclearization through these talks.
There are already established communication links, back-channel links, if you will, in New York at the UN. If they were really interested in substantive talks, they would pursue those back-channels?
North Korea and the United States have been pursuing track-to-dialogue since, several times since last year, at least. And these back-channels are usually in order to find out each other's intentions. North Korean government would like to send their people to the United States and hold talks in the United States. That way, they'll be able to discuss this matter, not just with their direct interlocutors for inviting them to the United States, but they will have the chance of talking to actual U.S. officials. And that way, North Korea will be sure about the United States' future strategy about North Korea.
Go Myung-yeon speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Two documentaries on the plight of refugees off of the Italian coast and the Greek coast, respectively, have received Oscar nominations this year. Fire by Sea by Gianfranco Rossi has been selected, and so has 4.1 Miles by Daphne Maziarocchi. VOA's Penelope Poulou has more.
Lampedusa. Over the past 20 years, the tiny Italian island, 120 kilometers off the Sicilian coast and 70 kilometers off the coast of Tunisia, has become a gateway to Europe for close to 500,000 refugees.
Your position, please. Your position.
Please, can you help us very quickly?
How many people?
150 people. We have small children. Please, can you help us? We are staying here in...
Through his cinematic masterpiece, Oscar-nominated Gianfranco Rossi conveys two different worlds inhabiting the tiny island. The quiet, unassuming islanders and the incoming migrants.
These two communities, the islanders and the migrants, never meet. So Lampedusa became almost like a metaphor of what's happening in the world, you know, these two forces that they barely touch each other and they never meet.
Rossi's documentary introduces a few islanders. Each one reflects the human condition in the middle of a world humanitarian crisis. He centers his film on Samuele, a Sicilian boy living on the island. Rossi likens his exuberance, roughhousing, as well as his tenacity and introspection to a humanity that has not yet reached maturity.
The anxiety of Samuele is our own anxiety. The wonder of Samuele is our own wondering. The lazy eye of Samuele is our lazy eye.
On the other end of the specter is Dr. Bartolo. As the only physician on the island, he examines every single refugee coming to Lampedusa and confirms the dead. Bartolo is the voice of reason and compassion.
Tutto questo ti lascia tanta rabbia, ti lascia un vuoto nello stomaco, un buco.
The refugee crisis is also at the center of Daphne Matsiaraki's short documentary, 4.1 Miles. The film, which also received an Oscar nomination, chronicles around-the-clock rescue missions off the Greek island of Lesbos. Coast Guard Kyriakos, the main character in the story, says that he and his team are called to rescue 200 people per hour. According to the film, between 2015 and 2016, 600,000 migrants crossed 6.5 kilometers of water, that is 4.1 miles, between Turkey and Lesbos.
I was proposing Lampedusa and Lesbos for the Nobel Prize, you know, these two special islands in the middle of nowhere that they welcome migrants from all over the world.
Rossi hopes his film helps bring awareness about the refugees' ordeal.
It's like in this moment, you know, when people say, what can I do now? Where do I stand? Which one is my position?
Your position. My friend. Hello. Hello.
Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks so much for joining us on International Edition. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.